Hello and welcome to episode 113 of Unfunny Nerd Tangent. My name is Greg, aka Captain Boomerang, coming to you from Australia and more specifically Queensland, that is, to take a look at the 1988 Eddie Murphy film Coming to America. And with me to discuss the ongoing political situation of Zamunda before we change the name of the show from Unfunny Nerd Tangent to The Three Putzes in Phoenix, Arizona. He likes to let his soul glow, oh so silky smooth, but also he wants his hair nice and neat for $8. He's the super Jew, Jared Rabinovitz.
That glow you see is my scalp. It's not actually hair. Oh, it's just scalp.
No, it's your soul. Come on.
I have no soul. Come on now.
Oh, that's true. Yes.
We're on Zoom right now, and it is kind of glowing, though. I know it's just the light, but still. Yeah.
It's not just the light. It's my aura.
Nice. Well, also in Phoenix, pound for pound, he might be the greatest snackologist that ever lived. Just don't mention Rocky Marciano. His mama named him Agni. I'm going to call him Agni. From attackofthedads.com, he's Tim Agni.
Greg, there's a very fine line between love and nausea, and that's how I feel about this podcast.
Yes. Also, we need an elephant called Babar, just for, you know, shits and giggles. All right. Well, first off, let's not bury the lead. Tim, you were telling me once you once met the director of the movie, John Landis. How did that happen?
Yeah. There were many years where I volunteered. Part of my scholarship at Arizona State University, there's a requirement that we had to put an X number of volunteer hours every year. And pretty quickly I fell in with the Phoenix Film Festival. I could get all my, it was like 40 hours a year we had to do something like that, but I could get all my volunteer hours while working at this film festival, meeting people like Jason Mewes and Danny Trejo and stuff like that. And so our friend Adam and I did this film festival. We were, and every year they'd bring in some assortment of celebrities. You know, they try to get, you know, somebody, whoever they could, usually like somebody would have a small film, they'd bring it in and get those guys to come out. And John Landis was there one year with a movie he directed called Slasher, which was this very kind of interesting but depressing, like sort of dramatized documentary about this guy whose job was to go around to used car lots, like in the Midwest, and do these things called slasher sales, where like the car would have like one price on the windshield and he'd like, you know, cut the price in half, you know, and somebody was going to get a car for $1 and all this other like gimmicky shit to try to help these used car lots move inventory. And of course he was like just a disgusting sleazy guy, this slasher guy, and the movie kind of followed him around. It was it was something. It was an interesting movie, I guess. It was pretty depressing overall. But then John Landis was there and I didn't have any kind of like a real interesting experience with him. I got to meet him and say hey and tell him I was, you know, you pretty much have to be a fan of something he's done. Like if you don't like, you know, the Thriller video or Animal House or the Blues Brothers, like you look at like his body of work and it's absolutely insane the stuff that his name is on. You know, An American Werewolf in London,
The Twilight Zone.
Well, The Twilight Zone is kind of its own story. But more recently, I guess, this thing surfaced with specifically about Coming to America and about this friction that developed between him and Eddie Murphy on the set of this movie. And kind of raised some questions about, like, specifically John Landis' attitudes towards his black lead actors and kind of how that all went down. It sounded like they were going back to this 1990 Playboy interview where Eddie Murphy was saying that he like punched John Landis on the set and knocked the wind out of him. But Landis was like mad at Eddie Murphy because...
Are we sure that wasn't Martin Luther King Jr.? Sorry, I had to do it. He knocked the wind out of me. Yes, he did.
That's true. That's based on when Martin Luther King Jr. punched John Landis in 1962.
He was 75 years old.
Landis had it coming.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you, but I couldn't miss that.
No, it's true. But it sounded like Eddie Murphy said he knocked the wind out of Landis on the set. And Landis like came up to him afterwards and did this like teary-eyed speech where he was mad at Murphy for not showing up at his trial, Because Greg, do you know much about this situation? Like why Landis was in trouble for the Twilight Zone thing?
Yeah.
go ahead.
Well, Vic Morrow, I'm pretty sure that's his name, the actor in one of the segments, him and two kids got killed in like a helicopter stunt. And like, he didn't just get killed as if like, that's not bad enough, but like he was decapitated by the helicopter blades. And there's actually footage of it on YouTube. You don't see the head fly off or anything like that. You just see the helicopter like just go fall on these people. And you're like, Jesus Christ. But apparently it was like a whole like safety issue, whether it was a negligence thing or just like, fuck it, let's just get it done. You know, like it was a dangerous sort of stunt with tons of shit going on at the same time. And it went bad as it could have, clearly. But yeah, there was a whole trial and stuff like that. So, and that's the thing I've seen about this beef with Eddie Murphy and Landis was like, I've seen quotes from Landis saying like, look, I directed Eddie Murphy in Trading Places when he was this kid and he was hot off of Saturday Night Live and like he was the nicest guy in the world and he was keen to do anything and all that kind of stuff. Then like we had him on Coming to America and he was like the pig of the world, I think was the quote, something like that. Like this guy that, you know, thought he was great and all that. And it's like, yeah. But I wonder how much of that is just, you've got this young kid comedian. He, of course, he's going to be super nice to you. Like it's one of his first movies. He's going to do anything you say. So maybe he put up with a lot of your shit. On the other hand as well, then you have Eddie Murphy's side of the story where he's like, you know, I felt bad for John Landis because of he had like three or four shit movies or bombs or whatever in a row. And then he had the whole Twilight Zone trial and his career was sort of hanging by a thread. He goes, so we brought him in to do Coming to America and he's trying to like act as if I wasn't doing this and I wasn't doing that. He goes, I hired him to direct the movie. Like, don't tell me I don't have your back, that kind of thing. And the movie made, you know, $300 million on a $36 million budget or something like that. And that's just like, so I don't know. But they clearly patched things up because like they worked together on Beverly Hills Cop 3, which isn't a great movie, but I mean, clearly they worked together again. So.
Yeah, and it's weird that all the, you know, stuff is coming back around. You know, I think it's probably because I don't think Landis is involved in the sequel now, is he?
He's not directing
He's not. It's a director that Murphy worked with for Dolomite Is My Name. Mm-hmm. His name's Craig Brewer. He also did Black Snake Moan.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that's why this is all coming back again, is because Landis probably feels shut out and it, you know.
Yeah. Well, when you get every single person back again, it's kind of like, except the director, it's kind of like, oh, really? And of course, yeah, I mean, beyond this will lead into the actual movie talk, I guess, but like beyond the Beverly Hills Cop movies, I would say this movie and Trading Places are sort of the big Eddie Murphy movies. If you don't count things like Shrek and, although I guess The Nutty Professor, I'm not a fan, but they were huge movies, but
they were massive movies. And yeah, it was kind of a whole reinvention. Well, not really a reinvention because a lot of what he did in Coming to America is what he was doing in The Nutty Professor, just more.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, we are only a couple of weeks away from the sequel coming out, which I never thought they'd do a sequel at all, really, because it's all kind of neatly contained. It's another story, like going back to America. It's like, all right, whatever. But now they're doing it, I guess, in the age of, I mean, we got old Rocky, we got old Bill and Ted, we got old Jay and Silent Bob, you know, like we might as well have old Akeem.
Well, we're remaking everything at this point, so why not do that, or sequeling everything? Yeah. So I'm glad they're, you know, at the very least, they're doing it as a sequel, not a remake.
Yeah, that's...
They're not trying to do that. We'll see how the movie is, and part of the reason we're doing this podcast is because we want to cover that one. So we're doing this as kind of a primer for everybody to watch that one when it comes out on Amazon or whatever service, you know, down in Australia, you guys may actually get to go to see it in a movie theater.
No, it's on Amazon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's Amazon only down here. So, but yeah, well, I did find out we'd be getting the Snyder Cut the same day as you guys as well. So.
Hey, nice.
I'm sorry. Blame Tim for that.
On our cable subscriber thing. So there you go.
That means I'm going to make you watch it.
Yeah. Oh, I'll watch it. Don't worry about that. I'll be watching it.
Tim, you know there's reason we're watching. We're only watching just to be able to, you know, give you shit about this movie.
Just watching to see when the Leonard Cohen's going to drop. I think that's that's what fans are clamoring for. Yeah. We want the black costume and Leonard Cohen. I think that's
what we're
expecting there.
They're saying that, you know, it's a 4-hour movie. I just wonder, is it a 2-hour movie in slow motion? That's all I'm thinking.
it's a 1-hour movie at 1/4 speed.
Yeah. But anyway, we'll cover the Snyder Cut when it happens. But yeah, this
one thing about the streaming service though, Amazon, I gotta tip my hat to what they're doing with Coming to America, because they made the first movie available and you can stream it in 4K with your subscription out here.
Yep.
And that's, you don't always get that. Sometimes a sequel comes out for a movie, whether it's in theaters or something or on a streaming service, and the original movie is like nowhere to be found. It's like you can't find it on DVD, you can't find it streaming anywhere, you know, and you wind up having to do like a digital rental or something like that.
We've had to do that for a couple podcasts now where we're trying to cover something and it's just like, oh yeah, it's not on any of the streaming services.
Yeah, I think, and when we did Predator, I think there was one something like that, but anyway. Yeah,
and you'd think that somebody would be pouncing on that, or at least they'd be doing some kind of a, you know, do a 4K re-release of the original Predators or something, you know, where you can where fans who want to can have access to that you know, catalog material. But Amazon, not only did they make that available, they got a couple of other Eddie Murphy movies streaming. If you wanted to watch Harlem Nights or Vampire in Brooklyn, they don't have Trading Places, which seems like I don't know, they exist in the same shared universe, right?
That's right. Yeah. Which, but yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, you should own Trading Places physically. Come on. That's one of those movies. You have to have it. If it's problematic these days or whatever, you know.
Trading Places is streaming on Stars right now. That's probably why Amazon doesn't have it. It's probably one of those rights issues.
Well, with this movie, it did drop in 88. And I mean, it was pretty much a massive hit from the beginning. When did you guys come across it? Like, I saw it on TV of all things. So it was cut to shit, you know, originally, but then, yeah, I managed to see it on home video after that, which, I mean, same with Trading Places, which, I mean, I wasn't probably supposed to have seen them, but it was the 80s. We handled things. But yeah, how'd you guys first come across it?
So I didn't come across it until the early 2000s, when I found out about it through a reference on Ludacris's album. Yes, I know it's stupid, but his second album starts off with the whole, "The royal penis is clean, your highness." And he does a couple bars that are coming. The track is Coming to America, like the same way the sequel is. And so I was like, what the fuck is this? And mind you, I'm in high school at this time. And I look it up and it's like, oh, it's Coming to America. And then I watched it. And I think I probably found it on demand or something at that point. Because that was when if you had HBO, you had HBO on demand, not the new services. But I think I watched it on there or something like that. And I haven't watched it since. So 20 years since I last watched it.
there's probably a ton of hip hop references to the show. I was just reading something that said that in the Kanye West song Gold Digger, when he says,
we don't use that name here, Tim.
When he says, this week is mopping floors, next week it's the fries, that's like a reference to Louis Anderson's little monologue about how he's going to be an assistant manager.
The one white guy in the whole movie.
Right. But for me, you know, Coming to America seemed like this movie that was always around and it would be on TV from time to time. And I know I'd seen it a few times, but never like, you know, sitting down right now and watching it in 4K where you get, I think that, you know, the whole royal penis is clean thing, that's a whole sequence that just has like all this gratuitous nudity and stuff like that. And that's not in the thing at all, you know, and it's great to go back and watch that in glorious 4K streaming. So
thank you, Amazon. That was on the TV version that I saw. That was always
no
in
way.
Well, yeah. Wow. Never. The only thing they cut was were the fucks. Like, no, you dumb fuck. And they just would, like the taxi driver screams at him, They just would,
shut
they would just
the fuck up.
They don't even dub it over like they do here with like.
Oh, they did. They would dub it over, so it was like, "You dumb frick."
You dumb.
What does "dumb frick" fool. Mean? Yeah, yeah. It was just like, yeah.
So on our typical tangent, I started rewatching Breaking Bad and on Netflix, and apparently the first episode has tits in it, and I did not realize that. Like, I don't remember that from the original run. And it's just straight up just a shot of a girl's tits. When Jesse is jumping out of the window of a house in like the first 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I did not remember there being any nudity, and it's AMC. Like, how'd they get away with this?
I might have seen it on a DVD that I borrowed from Brian, and I'm not sure if those, you know, if that was actually in the AMC broadcast or not.
Yeah, because I didn't watch it on DVDs. I had it on downloads. So,
yeah, I was lucky with Breaking Bad. I watched it. By the time I sort of started watching it, it was about maybe halfway through the final season. So I sort of just binged the whole thing. And then it was just, I finished when I was up to date with it. It was like, oh, there's like two episodes left. Okay. And then I had to wait a week for the final episode, and that was it. So I was really lucky, because that show would have driven me out of my mind if I had to wait like a year to find out whether Jesse killed the guy or not. You know,
it was rough, because I caught it like probably halfway through the second season when I started watching, third, somewhere around there. So yeah,
well, there's a sneak peek into the eventual Unfunny Nerd Tangent Breaking Bad show.
Sorry, it was just just mentioning the gratuitous nudity. Yeah. Just through that memory.
Did any of you guys ever watch Downton Abbey?
No.
Yeah, me neither. But like my understanding of the show is that there's a sequence kind of in the like early on where this guy comes back and is very uncomfortable having this butler like serve him, and it made me think about that in the beginning of Coming to America, where you know he basically he tells him to stop throwing rose petals at his feet, and like is that something that's like disrespectful to the, you know, because the rose petal, he calls them the rose bearers, like. Is that a good job? Is that, it probably is something that pays kind of well. It's not that hard of work.
Yeah, it is that sort of fine line of like, look, you don't have to do these things for me. It's okay, I'll do it. It's like anytime I've been to hospital where they're like, we'll wheel you out the door. It's like, dude, I'll just walk out. It's okay. Like I'm not.
I've fought with them on that, but that's a legal issue.
Yeah,
it's not a we're being nice. It's a, we have to get you off the prop out to the edge of the property, so we're no longer responsible for you if you trip and fall.
Yeah. But you sort of feel like, all right, I just sit there being like, let's go, take me to the end of the hospital, you know? But I mean, you do wonder what's the line of saying like, no, you don't have to do that for me because I'm not so precious. You have to brush my teeth for me and that sort of shit. But like, at what point did they say, but that's my job. Like if I don't do that, I'm not needed. Yeah. So what's
If that weird and completely gratuitous tradition is discontinued, then all of a sudden like these positions don't exist anymore. And you know, if you get another job around the palace, it's probably going to be a harder job.
Well, we do see later in the film like they are still rose bearers. They are still throwing rose petals at the king's feet, just not at Akeem's. So. Yeah.
Hopefully they come back for the sequel and are still able to throw the rose petals.
Yeah. That's what they should have on The Bachelor. It's just rose petals.
Yeah. Well, James Earl Jones is coming back, so you know he'll probably still get in the rose petals.
Yeah, that's it.
Once you only walk on rose petals, like, it'd be hard to just walk on floors.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like a sucker.
Yeah. Like just a common peasant.
Yeah. But the plot of the movie itself is really a modern for 1988, like a retelling of The Prince and the Pauper in a way. But I guess they had to sort of put a bit of a spin on it, because instead of just like, you know, air quotes, trading places with a poor person, which Eddie Murphy had already done a movie about, this time, like the prince just pretends to be a poor person to try and like woo a so-called like common woman, even though she's not common, but so I mean, I guess it is sort of that Prince and the Pauper thing, just without the pauper. He's just pretending. But I mean, it this really was sort of at the time when Eddie Murphy movies were like, it's the new Eddie Murphy movie. A bit like when, like, we covered Jim Carrey back in episode 94 and his sort of rise, you know, with Ace Ventura and The Mask and Dumb and Dumber and Cable Guy, all sort of in quick succession. It was like, what's the next Jim Carrey movie? Oh, it's Liar Liar. Okay, let's go see it. That sort of was how this movie sort of came out. Even as a kid, you could kind of tell, or I could kind of tell, like, oh, okay, now he's doing this movie. Oh, what's that about? But I mean, do you guys think that it works as far as like Eddie Murphy being the African prince and wanting to, like you said, Tim, like, I don't want rose petals. I don't want people brushing my teeth for me. I'll just do it myself. Like, do you think it works?
I was just trying to check real quick what he had done in between Trading Places. So like there was Trading Places, and that was a follow-up to 48 Hours. And then like he had both of the Beverly Hills Cop movie or 1 and 2 in there and the Golden Child before Coming to America come out. That's a hell of a run.
Yeah, and see, Golden Child's probably the only like dud in that. And even then, I don't think it's that bad a movie, but like critically and box office and all that, that was sort of like, oh, Eddie Murphy's like his bomb.
Isn't this kind of a cult movie now though, right? Like I feel like there's a handful of people who are real Golden Child stands.
And that's the thing though, like with these things where it's like, oh, it was a box office bomb. It's like, yeah, but it's weird to say that means just that people just didn't go see it at the cinema, but doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad movie. Like Shawshank Redemption made like hardly anything at the cinema, at the theaters. Then I mean, everybody, that's on everybody's top 10 list.
Is that one of those movies though? Did it win some Oscars and then maybe get a second run or something? Like,
I think it's, yeah, I think it sort of, I think at the time it came out, people were just like, what's this Stephen King prison movie? Meh. Well, Stephen King movies are pretty trash. I'm not going to bother with that. And then it sort of, I think people were getting it out on video and stuff like that. And then because it was on video, it looks like a Tim Robbins, Morgan Freeman prison movie. And you think, oh, I'll give that a chance. And you watch it and like, oh shit, this is great. And then, oh, by the way, it was like a Stephen King thing. So, yeah, I don't know. So Golden Child is kind of the asterisk in that period. But I mean, I'd have to rewatch it, but I don't ever remember thinking it was bad. But not like this one. This one's always been, I mean, this movie and Trading Places, they almost made my 40 for 40 when I was doing that up. And they were tough to cut, I tell you.
And this was coming right off the heels of Raw, which, you know, as far as stand-up films go, it's the highest grossing stand-up film at the box office in history still.
Wow.
So, and I'm not sure if that's adjusted or not, but you know, that there's not a ton of stand-up comedy films that happen.
Mm.
Like you can think of, you know, Kings of Comedy. What was it? Why am I blanking with Foxworthy and,
oh yeah, those guys. Billy guys, whatever they were called. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what that was, but
Larry the Cable Guy and all that, where there was four of them.
There's very few of those that actually like get to theaters, and that one was a big one, and that was a big event. So this was the movie coming right off of that. So yeah. Definitely a solid run for Eddie.
Oh yeah. And I think like there's one thing about this movie that gets overlooked, and I think it's sort of how genuine and, I don't know if sweet is the right word, but how genuine and sweet like Eddie Murphy's portrayal of Akeem is. Like, he's super naive about America, of course, but that's sort of the whole point. And it's played for laughs and all that. But this, like, this might be the most noble and decent character Eddie Murphy has ever played. You know, like even like Axel Foley and all that kind of stuff, like a good person, good cop and all that, but you know, street smart, smart ass, you know, cocky, all that sort of shit. Whereas Akeem is sort of just like super nice. You
know? Akeem is that, you know, what is it? A romanticist. He wants that romantic idea of, you know, love. He's got all these things, but he just wants love and to be loved for who, for himself, not his riches. So we see that type of movie a lot, where it's somebody who's rich trying to find somebody who loves them for who they are, or, you know, not because of their looks, but, you know, you can alternate what it is. But this was, as far as Eddie Murphy goes, this is almost a rom-com in that regard.
Oh yeah,
It's you know, classified more as a comedy, but I don't think many people consider it a true rom-com. But
yeah, not in the stereotypical sort of cliched formulaic way, but I mean it really is, though. You're right. Like it is. It does have that. I mean, all the sort of tropes are there. It's like, you know, guy meets girl, there's issues.
Girl's already got a boyfriend.
Exactly. Yeah. He's got a secret. Ooh, well, you know, and then they do get together, but then, oh no, when she finds out, everything will go to shit. And it does. And then, so they break up. And then of course they sort of eventually you get the happy ending kind of thing. So, but it's just,
I had this idea in my head. Before I like rewatched the movie today, I had this idea in my head of Akeem being like the mold for like these Adam Sandler romantic lead type guys, where he's just like this kind of weird goofy guy, but then like, you know, you get him in a romantic situation and he's like the most perfect boyfriend ever. but that's not Akeem at all. Like I was very wrong about that. Like going back and watching, like Akeem's he's a cool guy from the very beginning. You know, you watch, you know, you see him like doing all this royal stuff, and like he looks pretty awesome from the outset, and it's never like the joke is never on him. Like he's still you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're laughing with him, you're not laughing at him. Yeah, you're laughing along as if like, oh look, he doesn't understand, you know, like that, you know, he had to pay $8 for the barber to just snip one little ponytail thing, you know, and that sort of shit, because to him he's like $8, what?
Right.
Like, you know, everyone else is like $8 for that, you know, whereas like he's like, I've got billions of dollars, or you know, who cares, you know. And he lets this, within 5 seconds of them being in Queens, all their stuff is stolen, and he's just like, let them have it, who cares, these people are poor, like let them have our things. He doesn't give a shit. So
it says that $8 today would be worth $17.69 in 2021 dollars.
So that's about what a haircut costs now.
I mean, that's true.
You're $15 plus tax and tip. You know?
Full price, yeah. That's,
this is why I cut my own hair.
There you go.
The few of them that I have left, you know, which are not equivalent.
Yeah. Easier for some people than others.
I go to a fancy hairstylist and pay a lot more, and I'm not royalty, and I have to just earn that money. By which I mean my wife earns it and I just spend it.
Yeah, we know.
Yeah.
Okay. But I think having Eddie Murphy and Akeem as this sort of super decent, noble, literally a noble prince, it really helps the story and the comedy, because in contrast, like America and Queens and New York and all that looks like this crass, trashy place around him. I don't know, in the 80s.
It's Queens. It's, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think it changed much on King of Queens or anything like that.
That's
any other portrayal of Queens shows it much different.
And I mean, at the same time, though, while you've got Akeem as this kind of like almost perfect person in Queens and dealing with all that, you've got Semi with Arsenio Hall as his best friend, and kind of, I don't know what he's meant to be, like not bodyguard, but he clearly has some role because you see him, they train together and stuff like that, unless they're just really good friends, I guess. But that then gives you like this other character who you can kind of, he's almost the middleman, you know, like he's crass and trashy and all this kind of stuff like Queens is, but he's still naive about what's going on because he's just not from there.
And I don't think he's crass or trashy. He's opportunistic.
Well, yeah, like, I
guess he's got the opportunity to be the one living large for a change, and you know, the one getting the recognition. And so he is. And I think that's
I guess
that's working.
Trashy is the wrong word for him, but he's definitely arrogant and vain and chauvinistic and stuff like that.
Although I get the sense that he seems to be somebody who enjoys a lot of the same luxuries that Akeem does. You know, he's not royalty maybe himself, but he's got the proximity and he's got the access where like maybe he doesn't have his own bathers, but maybe he still gets to take a bath in there every once in a while. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You don't get the bathers, but you get the access to the hot tub. That's you know,
yeah.
Yeah,
that's why he missed it so much. And you need to put one in the apartment. You know, when you get accustomed to being able to go sit out after a hard day of work, go sit in a hot tub and just relax. You miss that. You just can't, it's hard to live without it.
It's harder for him to give it up too, because he's, you know, he's working for that. You know, he's got to make sure that he's keeping Akeem and the royal family happy so that he keeps his access to all that stuff. And now here's Akeem just saying like, nope, we're not going to have any of it. We're going to just live in poverty.
He's also got to do that to keep his life, because I'm pretty sure the king would kill him if he failed. You know, there seems to be some implications of that.
You know,
you do a really good job. You get all the trappings of luxury here. You screw up, you're literally dead. So it's
but
really
he seems
a rage.
Like, the king seems very menacing, but then when Semi finally gets busted later on, his punishment is you go immediately to the Waldorf Astoria and you stay in the penthouse and think about what you did.
It's all right then. But I mean, that training, it's something that like movies in the 80s and to a degree the 90s, but especially like 80s comedies did, where they were able to introduce a character and you know everything about them within about a minute. You know, like the original Ghostbusters did the same sort of thing, where it's like, here's Venkman, here's Ray, here's Egon, you know, 5 minutes, you know who they are, right, let's get on with it. And the jokes work because you understand that why that's funny because of who they are. So like this movie does the same thing, because you have Akeem within the first 5 minutes of the movie being like, can't I do things for myself? And can't I choose my own wife and this kind of stuff? And then Sammy comes along and he's like, hippopotamus shit. You know, like your wife should just be hot and all this kind of stuff. Like, who gives a shit, you know? You know, like basically like, shut the fuck up. You've got the best of everything. Like, why are you complaining? So then when you get to America, you already know who they are. You know their attitude towards life and everything like that. So I just think like there's a lot of stuff now, like a now movie would do it and it would be like 10 separate little scenes of that sort of stuff.
Part of that is, I think, you know, the style and the way we make movies has changed. Now, you know, what we were talking earlier, never expected a sequel to this movie. So you want to set up who character, and that was the common thing. You want to set up who characters are real quick, so you can get through a full story arc with them and you kind of know them and you can do all that. Now everybody's planning for a sequel or the remake or whatever it is, and you want a series of these things. So you want to drag it out so people want more and more of the character. And it's not just here's an hour and a half with these characters. You got to know them quick to get through the story and be attached. Now they're trying to build it into, you do it over the course of 2, 3, 4 films, whatever.
Yeah, I feel the only thing that they kind of spent, not too much time or anything like that, but they did spend a lot of time on, was setting up Zamunda itself. Obviously, like all the scenes with the palace are all like the most luxurious places you could ever imagine. But they still try to remind you that they're sort of in the middle of Africa, because there's elephants walking around and that sort of stuff. And which is played for laughs, obviously. But I mean, I could see how the memes started around for this movie with Black Panther when it kicked off as well, because there's so many, I mean, it's a completely different movie, but there's so many like parallels and stuff like that. Like there's that, I remember there's that one picture of a guy in the theater about to sit down to watch Black Panther at the premiere. And he's literally wearing Akeem's outfit when they turn up at the airport and stuff like that. He's got the, whatever, the animal skins and the hat and everything. So, but yeah, I think that was set up really well. And then there's the big dance sequence, like to introduce Akeem's bride to be and that sort of stuff. But it still works, because they do all this stuff and you think, wow, this is really over the top. And this is, you know, like this massive big dance number and sort of thing in this comedy. But then you get the song by whatever his name is, like his you know, clap, clap helper guy that's just telling everyone to do this and do that. Like the song about, like your bride to be or your queen to be, that's just fucking hilarious. Like that just caps it off. And just the lyrics,
the dance was
as
choreographed.
Well.
It was choreographed by Paula Abdul, by the way. That's,
oh wow, okay.
An interesting little thing to pop up from the credits.
There you go.
So it's not authentically African, but it was still pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah. And it was definitely, you know, you have the moment where they're trying to play it up for laughs and stuff that you probably couldn't do this anymore, which is where you've got the one woman and he's like, oh no, that's her. And then you get the beautiful woman.
Yeah. Now to be like, oh my God, what is she not good enough for you? It's like,
but we've also seen a lot of that where, you know, in comedies where it's the reverse, where all of a sudden the guy's thinking it's the beautiful woman. And they're like, no, her. And it's the one off eating somewhere. I'm sure
someone's so the old trope of they wave, you know, and then the guy waves back, and then it's like, oh no, they're waving to that guy behind you, you know, like Spider-Man does that. I remember that Tobey Maguire waving back at Summer Teeth and just be like, yep. And then she's not waving at you, dude. And then of course, like Tim, you're the big one in Swingers.
The baby talk
with the baby,
where it's an actual baby, where it's just
that's probably the most like egregious, but I mean,
tough beat for Vince Vaughn there.
I'm surprised as well this movie hasn't copped shit just from people, because not because it deserves it, but because it seems like the sort of thing that people these days would jump on without actually understanding the nature of what's actually happening in the scene. But the whole like bark like a dog thing, where he's like, hop on one foot, you know, bark like a dog, a big dog, you know, all that sort of shit, and she and the bride to be does it. Now I could see people like clutching their pearls and be like, oh my God, like they're objectifying her. It's like, no, that's the point. He's trying to show her how ridiculous it is that she just does everything she's told like a robot because he happens to be the prince. Like,
yeah, and that's why I don't think that scene would get. I think that one would be fine now because it is showing the absurdity, and he's not doing it because he's trying to, you know, demean her. He's trying to prove
that's right. Yeah.
This isn't an equitable exchange here. He's like, I want an actual relationship. I want somebody who is going to stand up to me. And that's what makes that different. And I think it's still absurd and ridiculous.
Oh yeah,
but I think you can still do something close to that.
And that's exactly right. Like that's the exact point of that scene. But I could see some people these days just being like, oh my God.
It's more broadly kind of just lampooning the excesses of royalty, you know, and the kinds of absurd things that you know, wealth and power get you. But one thing that I think it seems like it never really punches down at any particular African cultures. Like you get a couple of offhanded comments that like you know, directed toward Akeem throughout the movie where you know the landlord is like a bit of a bug problem, but you boys are from Africa, you're probably used to that, you know.
Daryl says that to him a couple of times too. It's like, oh, you know what?
Yeah,
you don't have sports over there, you'd just be like chasing tigers and shit or whatever it is, and it's like there's not even tigers in Africa, but like it's like but that sort of shit. And he's like, no, we play soccer and all that kind of stuff.
But and even like and just about every time that, you know, we hear a comment like that, like those comments are absurd too, but they're made by absurd
characters as well, like they're made by characters, and that's the problem now with movies as well. Some character will say something terrible and they'll be like, you can't say that. That's such an ignorant attitude about XYZ. It's like, yes, but it's coming from the ignorant character. You're meant to look at them and go, what an idiot, you know, like that person is, you know, and that sort of thing. You know, but that's again another thing that's lost in movies these days. But yeah, I just thought like I do like that scene, and that's another Trading Places connection as well, because that's where Eddie Murphy he breaks the fourth wall in that scene and looks to the camera like he does in Trading Places, where they're like, and that's a similar sort of comedy where they're like, you know, where they're like, oh, and we deal in bacon that you might have on a bacon lettuce tomato sandwich, like they're talking to him like he's a fucking 2-year-old because he's a black guy and they're these like super old racist white guys, and he just does that, like, you know, look to the camera. He does that in this when she barks like a dog. He's like, this looks like, can you believe this shit? But obviously it works because, like you said, Eddie Murphy, John Landis, they're definitely the connection. Before we go any further, I guess while we're still on Zamunda, we have to talk about James Earl Jones being King. Is it King Joffy? Joffy, however you pronounce it.
Joffy Jaffer.
Yeah. I think even at the time, having Darth Vader as the king of Zamunda was awesome. Like, just some of the lines he says, and like, you know, because you're my son, and like, you know, I could, you know, no more, and all this just sort of things that could easily be a Vader quote. I think that was great. And then after this, he became Mustafa, and the circle was complete. So,
yeah. Well, and his queen, Madge Sinclair, was also Simba's mother, Sarabi, I think, in The Lion King.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's awesome. Right. Oh, there you go.
So I don't know why they didn't just cast Eddie Murphy as Simba at that point.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because he had to wait to play Donkey.
That's true.
Yeah.
I think they paid off for him, I think. That was...
Yeah.
I said, Donkey's still one of my favorites.
It's a good... character.
I like that too, because you can tell a lot of that it's a lot of Eddie Murphy, I think, that they added to the script and things like that, as opposed to being like, say this, say that. You know, he's created probably 65-70% of that character just with his ad-libs, which, especially with Mike Myers being involved as well, he'd be all over that. But I like James Earl Jones in this, because I think in the hands of maybe a lesser actor or someone without the presence that he has, the king could come off as more of a villain, which because a lot of the things he does for a romantic comedy villain anyway, he is kind of a bit of an obstacle in a lot of ways and things like that, and threatens to derail everything and sort of destroy all the plans. But I think he's so charming and likable. It's you know, the worst he ever is at the end, where he's like, $1 million for your daughter and to go away and this kind of thing. That's the only point where it's like he's sort of a shithead, but that helps the Cleo stand up, you know, and make him look awesome. So and the mother too, the queen, she steps up.
And he just that voice is just a commanding presence. Like, you don't have to do anything more than have that voice to get people's attention and to have that like instant authority behind it. And I don't know if that's just because of how deep his voice is or just how we've heard it play over the years, but you know, he just has that stature just from the voice. So it works. And he clearly is a loving father, but he's set in some old ways. Like, he doesn't want his son to go without. That's the thing, is, you know, but it's just a different mindset.
He's got a lot of the funniest lines in the whole movie too, like the love and nausea thing. I tied my own shoes once.
Yeah.
And then, my favorite is I always assumed you had sex with your royal bathers. I know I do.
Yeah.
So good.
And at the start as well, you've grown a mustache, and she's like, the wife is like, it's been a year. Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Oh God, he's coming here. What's going on? And he's hitting the button.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that would have maybe been one of the quickest casting decisions ever. I'm sure in 1987, 1988, they were like, okay, we need someone to be Eddie Murphy's dad, who's also the king of this like highly, the super rich African nation. They would have just gone, James Earl Jones. Yep.
Yeah.
Great. Perfect. Like, no need to overthink it. So yeah, but he does a good job, I think.
Does a great job. Like,
absolutely. Yeah. So once we're in America, though, we do get the opposing nature of Akeem and Sammy. Like we said, one is kind of, Akeem is obviously trying to live the pauper lifestyle, and Sammy doesn't want anything to do with it. And I think that a lot of that, the comedy from that movie then comes from like the apartment they find themselves in as well. Like, I mean,
poor?
Yeah, I love the landlord, and just especially later where he's just like, you know, Sammy decks out their apartment with all the rich shit, and it's like, we need a new apartment. This one is not good enough. He's like, oh, you can have mine. Like, because he looks at all the shit, and I just love it. He's like, is it meager or is it poor? And he's like, yeah, it's a real shithole. Yeah,
you'll love it.
Yeah, and just the nature of I think, is it Frankie Faison or something, some name like that.
Yeah, Frankie Faison.
Just the back and forth that he does to show that all this guy cares about is money and you know, getting what he can, where he just, you know, they knock on the door originally. He's like, what the fuck do you want? And then they're like, we have money. He's like, gentlemen, come inside. You know, like, he's super nice to him. And then, like you said, Tim, like, oh, sorry, I was I was Kurt before, but we get some real shitheads around here and all this kind of stuff. Like the guy, and then the guy rolls down the stairs trying to get out of his rent. And he just screams at him like, you know, you owe me rent, motherfucker. Like he's just straight at him. And then, oh, gentlemen, upstairs, you know. So,
and what's funny is I'm looking at his bio right now, and he started off actually early with working with James Earl Jones. His first, he started his acting in New York Shakespeare Festival production of King Lear with James Earl Jones in the title role. And then he actually won a Tony Award playing against James Earl Jones in Fences on Broadway. So they have a connection there. But I know him, you know, I like the show, and I think I mentioned it before on, it was on Cinemax called Banshee.
Ah, yeah, and, I keep meaning to watch that, yeah.
And he had a great role as a character named Sugar on there, former boxer, who's kind of like the advisor, kind of, who kind of knows what's going on. He's also kind of like the underground, not like Kingpin, but he's the guy who, when you need something underground, kind of knows everybody and mm-hmm. knows how the players move, and the guy you go to. So he was really good on that.
And a better boxer than Rocky Marciano.
Well, that, speaking of Marciano, I do want to talk about the multiple characters that are in this movie that are played by Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall. And I mean, Jared, you said you went back to watch this movie, so I'm sure you were fully aware. Tim, when did you see this as a kid or relatively young? Or
Yeah, I saw it as a kid when it was, you know, when it was on TV, and I don't think I put it all together.
No, I think the only one, because I was going to say, I had no idea it was any of them were him, except for the only one I thought was Arsenio Hall he's the big masculine woman in the.
Well, yeah, club. That was.
I mean, that's so obvious. Even as a kid, I was like, oh, that's him. That's pretty funny.
Yeah. That's because they kept cut. They made sure that one was obvious.
That's right, and just the whole like, "I'm gonna tear you apart," and your friend too, just like the spit take, yeah. But I remember, and that. So I'm watching the end credits, and it's, you know, Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall, you know, Eric LaSalle, James Earl Jones, and it's like Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall. You know, someone else, Eddie Murphy. And it's just all through all these guys. I was like, holy shit. And then, of course, because you've got, Randy Watson, obviously, and the Reverend, that there's those two. There's the barbershop guys. And then, but of all people for Eddie Murphy to be, he's Saul, like the old Jewish guy. that just blew my fucking mind. I'm like, at first I thought, oh, that's just a joke. Like, because they played all these other characters and the joke is, oh, this is Eddie Murphy too, but clearly it isn't, because like, that's still got to be one of the best makeup jobs I've ever seen.
Yeah. And it became a trademark of Eddie Murphy to play multiple characters in everything he did.
Yeah.
From here on out.
Well, that's, yeah, he does it again in, Tim, you brought up like Vampire in Brooklyn and we said Nutty Professor before, and then of course, Norbit, but... which is, people probably forget all about that movie. The movie that cost Eddie Murphy an Oscar. That's what I like to call it. but yeah, I think, I don't know. Any, do you have a favorite of all those guys? Like of the extra characters?
Oh, I think, which the barber.
Yeah.
Clarence. Yeah. I think he's just hilarious. Just every time getting caught in a lie. Every time.
Yeah. All the boxing talk, of course. That shit, you know. I suppose no one's heard of Cassius Clay. And it's like, oh, I liked him until he changed his name to Muhammad Ali and all this kind of shit. Like, you know. And then, yeah. What is that? And then Rocky Marciano, and he says how he beat up Joe Louis. And he's like, Joe Louis is 75 years old. You know, he came out of retirement. He was 75 years old. Because I spoke to Frank Sinatra, and I said, "How old is Joe Louis?" He said, "Joe Louis is 137 years old." You know, like all that kind of shit.
And you can draw a direct line from that character to the character Cedric the Entertainer played in the barbershop movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they really do the same stuff, and you know that those scenes basically bring out a lot of the barbershop movies and. which those are good movies to go back and watch too. I haven't watched those in a while.
He carries it really well. Just the like when they're arguing, fuck you, and fuck you. He's like, who's next? In they come. And one of the few cameos in this movie as well, Cuba Gooding Jr. sitting in the chair getting his haircut.
or not getting it cut, really. He's just, snipping the scissors in the air. Like,
There's a lot of high school play acting in this movie, I call it, where he's not cutting anywhere near him. If you watch the drummer in Sexual Chocolate, he's not hitting the drums at all. the hi-hat and he's about this far, he's half a foot away from the hi-hat. It's crazy.
That's because Randy Watson has it covered. You don't need to actually play the drums. But Randy Watson is the star attraction.
It's hard to imagine anybody getting such a lukewarm reception for that performance. Everybody just wants him to go away.
Except for the one guy that's not played by Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall in the barbershop. He's just like, the boy's good. he's a big Randy Watson fan. I love that. The whole thing of Randy Watson, I mean, it's become a gif that everybody uses, the arms up and then the Scott Hall point to get out. All that shit. Love it. But it's funny though. They play all these characters and then, which are sort of, I guess, cameos by themselves. But I mean, there are a couple of other cameos when we spoke about, I don't know if you call Louis Anderson's role a cameo, but I mean, he's got a decent part, but I mean, it's kind of like, oh, there he is. The Samuel L. Jackson cameo though, that's one of those things where I think most people that saw this movie saw it and then went, oh yeah, there's the guy that comes in and tries to rob the place and they take him down. And then when you've watched it back 10 years later, you're like, that's Samuel L. Jackson.
And that was one of his first parts that he even got credited for.
Oh, wow.
Was doing that. So this was early on because he had, at that point, he did Coming to America. He had done something he was gang member number two in a movie called Ragtime. He played a bum in the movie Magic Six that doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. He showed up in Eddie Murphy's Raw, and then it was Coming to America.
Wow.
So really,
Oh yeah, he's his dad, I think, on Raw at the start of Raw when it's like a little like a sitcom-y sort of thing of Eddie and his family and stuff. I think he plays his dad.
Yeah,
he's been in so many movies. Does he still hold that record for highest box office average?
Oh, I think so. He'd have to, surely.
Coming to America couldn't have hurt that.
Just the Avengers movies alone would.
Oh yeah.
He's in the three prequels.
The Star Wars.
Star Wars prequels. He's in obviously.
I think he had that before the Avengers movies too. He was even Nick Fury, he was already that guy.
Yeah, so I mean, they would have just absolutely pushed it to the very top, I think. And because Jurassic Park as well. The first Jurassic Park. So Pulp Fiction probably wasn't a huge earner. Obviously, it's a massive movie, but it probably didn't make huge amounts of money.
That him being the highest grossing was done in 2009 by Guinness. In 2011, somebody else did one where it said he was the second highest grossing actor behind a voice actor. Frank Welker.
It's your guy, Frank Welker.
Yeah.
Take that, Sam.
Yeah, but since 2009, you look at Samuel L. Jackson's run. You could argue it's probably gone up since then.
Yeah, easily.
I mean, with all the Avengers movies, with the Incredibles, Kong.
Yeah.
Although XXX Return of Xander Cage may take that little bit.
And all the money Glass brought in.
Oh, yeah.
I still like that movie. Anyway.
So do I. I mean,
Frank Welker, also in The Lion King. Yeah. Doing a bunch of roars and stuff.
Frank Welker's in everything. Yeah. I reckon if we went through all the 113 episodes of Unfunny Nerdtender, I reckon we could probably find Frank Welker in 100.
He's probably just some of the background voices in this movie. You need somebody to say something off camera.
Yeah. He's one of the elephants.
You made that joke about Glass. Glass still made $250 million.
Wow.
I mean, wow. It's at 250 million. So, you know, that's not exactly chump change for a movie.
That's right. Yeah. So, but yeah, it made
more than Shaft did by factor 10.
Yeah. With Christian Bale. People forget Christian Bale's in that movie.
In the 2019 Shaft film?
No, the Shaft, the one from, not 2019.
Yeah, I was looking at the 2019 Shaft when I said it. That one made $21
million. Wasn't Samuel L. Jackson in the one from, like, whenever it was, 1998?
He was.
Right. I think he was, too. Yeah.
And I remember the joke back then being that he was actually older than the original Shaft.
Mm.
Yeah.
You shut your mouth. Shaft.
The Shaft from 1999 made $100 million. So
there you go.
Or from 2000.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, that's the one. Christian Bale. Everyone forgets he's in.
Yeah.
Where he's basically Eric Trump. But anyway, he's ahead of the time. Eric Trump begins with Christian Bale.
What movie are we covering again right now? we out-tangented in our tangent self.
That's right. Well, the other cameos that I really wanted to talk about, because like while we're talking about the Avengers and the MCU and crossovers and all that, like the Dukes from Trading Places turn up in this movie as like the bums on the street that Akeem gives money to. And just, when I saw that as a kid, that blew my fucking mind. I was like, they're the guys from the Trading Places. Like, what the fuck? Like, it's the same thing. Like, it just, yeah. It because you didn't have that back then. Like, there were a couple of things here and there, but like, especially as a kid, like occasionally, you know, like Kermit the Frog would go back and forth between the Muppet Show and Sesame Street. But like, beyond something like that as a kid, it wasn't like, yeah, you know, oh yeah, this shared universe and all this kind of stuff. But like just that small moment, and just, I just love the callback that Eddie Murphy is the one to take the money away from the Dukes in Trading Places. And Eddie Murphy is the money, is the guy that gives the money back to the Dukes in Coming to America. So yeah, I don't know. I just, the whole Randall Mortimer thing. I love it. So what about, as far as villains go for the movie, like we said, if it's a rom-com, then we do have the ex, or the current boyfriend, who's a bit of a shithead, who becomes the ex-boyfriend and wants to cause trouble with Eric LaSalle as Daryl. I gave you the Soul Glow intro, Jared, but like every time I watch this movie, I have that fucking song stuck in my head for about a week. Like, it's just... And it's still in my head now. Like, it's just like, it's played for laughs, but like, Jesus, the guy singing that, he fucking goes for it.
Oh yeah. are we sure it wasn't Randy Watson?
Yeah, that's too good. It's too good for Randy Watson. The guy, no, this guy's drummer hits his drums. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. How do you, the whole Soul Glow thing sort of, he's clearly like the heir, you know, to the fortune and all this. And later we see his family and they all have the same hair.
Well, yeah, like, you got to support the family business.
That's right. Yeah. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. He does a good job, I think, of being that sort of shithead character, but he's not a full villain. You know what I mean? Like, he's not Bradley Cooper in Wedding Crashers. You know,
I was thinking about that, because Wedding Crashers always pissed me off. I have such strong opinions about Wedding Crashers. because in the end, Rachel McAdams only leaves Bradley Cooper when she finds out that he was cheating on her.
Not because he's a bad person.
Yeah. Not because he's horrible. Yeah, that's fine, and they're still going to get married. He can be as much of a shithead and make her miserable, but they still have to get married until he is unfaithful. And it's like, why? You know, why do we need that extra little nudge? Why can't she just realize, like, hey, this is not a good relationship for me. I'm not happy. I'm going to go, you know, marry Owen Wilson now. And so in this case, I've forgotten his name now. Daryl. Daryl, who was like the one actor not coming back for the sequel.
Oh, Eric LaSalle.
But part of it, I think, is he's not really acting anymore and doesn't want to, he says.
Really?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know. But Daryl, for him to kind of, you know, he doesn't even do anything that's that bad necessarily, except for like, he is, you know, we see it over and over again, feels this kind of entitlement where he sort of is buying his way into love, you know, over and over again, kind of bribing her dad.
Hey, I got tickets to the football game.
Yeah.
But he does seem like he, like at the start of the movie, you know, you have Akeem saying like to his bride-to-be, you know, bark like a dog, jump on one foot, and then kind of being like, no, I don't want that. Like, what sort of foods do you like? And, you know, she's like, whatever you like. And it's like, no, I want to know what you think. Like, whereas like Daryl would be like, this is great. I love it.
Yeah.
Like he's the rich guy. If they were to do this, you know, like I said before, the Prince and the Pauper thing where they swap places, but if you were to swap places with who should be like, who should have each other's life, like they're the two that you would do it, because Daryl would love all that shit of just being like, I don't care. I just got this hot woman who just, she does anything I tell her and she's just completely subservient and all this kind of stuff. Like he loves all that. Whereas Akeem is like, no, I want a woman to talk to and blah, blah, blah. Whereas, yeah. And I mean,
but
that's the thing.
But like, Akeem, he saw the Soul Glow commercial and he does want the hair. He wants it.
Well, he wants the hair because he thinks that's what Lisa wants. Yeah.
Right. So, well, yeah. And because the commercial absolutely slaps. Like, don't forget.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like,
he saw the commercial before he saw Lisa, I think.
But the, you know, like the whole, like he essentially, like Lisa finds out that they're engaged when like the dad announces it. And it's like, that's what she says. Hang on a minute. So the same way that like Akeem has a marriage arranged for him at the start and is like, fuck this. They sort of do that to Lisa as well, which is sort of interesting, I thought.
But see, the difference being is that Akeem knew he was getting into an arranged marriage. The woman knew she was going to be with the king in an arranged, or the prince in an arranged marriage. Lisa didn't know.
Yeah.
She just kind of got that sprung on her. So, you know, she had like no say in it at all. And that was just like, she's like, what is going on here? Why am I not consulted?
Yeah,
there's no, for her, there's no tradition, no expectation that marriage is going to be arranged. Like she's an American woman in the 80s. Like she expects to at least have somebody propose to her and be able to make her own choice.
Yeah. So I do think it's funny, like when it's, they have Lisa as this character and then, but then, yeah, like the dads are similar too, I guess, because yeah, she says to Cleo, his name is Cleo McDowell, you know, like you only like Akeem once you found out he was rich and all this kind of stuff. Whereas, yeah, he only seemed to like Daryl because he was the heir to the Soul Glow fortune. Yeah. And then once Akeem comes along and it's like, holy shit, like this guy, you know, he's got his own money. Like,
yeah,
his face is on the money. And the other great part we haven't discussed is that his younger daughter thought that Timmy was the prince.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That whole I like that too. Yeah.
Although she was about ready to get into bed with anybody. So
yeah, she kind of hits on Daryl then at the end as well. He's just like, no, whatever. he breaks the fourth wall too, looks at the camera as well. Just sort of like, whatever, I'm a bit of a shithead. Okay. So
But it's kind of an interesting idea of this question of like what is American royalty, you know, and it's presented. I didn't really pick up on like what you said, like this, like she's forced into an arranged marriage the same way that Akeem is. And yeah, in America, oftentimes we have these people come along who are like the wealthy heirs to these big companies, you know, so you've got your Paris Hiltons and your Army Hammers or whatever.
I want to eat you, Army Hammer.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And you can, and if you're, you know, when you have this kind of fortune behind you, you can just eat people.
Yeah. He's the Lone Ranger. Fuck it.
Yeah. Right.
and he's rumored to be in every superhero movie that's ever made.
That's true. Yeah, he's
and he's not in any of them.
He's never going to be Batman now.
No,
not even in a Lego movie.
No. Well, they already had American Psycho. It's Batman, so that
that's right.
when they reboot Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, as far as the McDowells go, though, I do like the whole McDowells, McDonald's ripoff thing, yeah. And just like, get out of here with that camera, I'll break it, you know.
When he's got the McDonald's employee handbook, that's when it's great.
Yeah. It's like, no, everything's different. Like, we're McDowells, they're McDonald's. It's like, they have the golden arches. I have the golden arcs. fuck, dude. Like, it's, and like, we don't have a sesame seed bun or something. It was something like that.
Right.
So at one point, a buddy of mine actually bought an old Dairy Queen location. But Tim, you know the one on Mill just south of Southern?
Oh, yeah.
That's our trooper.
Yeah.
So Hammer... I want to say this was like 2008, 2009, bought in with the owner of the tattoo shop, and they opened it up, and they basically just ripped off the entire Dairy Queen menu. it was just the Mill Ave Ice Cream Company. It, they still had the Dairy Queen sign was still up out front.
Oh, wow.
Because Dairy Queen didn't take it down. It had been a couple of years. And so they basically did the same thing.
There are a surprising number of businesses actually like that. You know, like there was in Mesa, Arizona, there was this Winchell's Donuts that eventually lost its Winchell's franchise, and they kept changing the name to like Venchell Donuts, and it became this like this big joke for anybody who lived around there. But but that sign stayed up forever, and there's got to be. There's probably a larger number than you think of examples of people doing this, of people trying to like the fake In-N-Out burger in New York City. Jared, you remember hearing about that?
I think so.
Like somebody tried to copy like the whole menu, like down to the font and everything. And it also reminds me of Nathan Fielder opening up Dumb Starbucks in LA. Did you guys, he just opened up a thing that was exactly Starbucks, but it was called Dumb Starbucks, and everything was just like, this is a dumb Frappuccino.
Starbucks with an X.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, podcasts too. Sometimes you get ripoffs of them, but as far as, I do like that John Amos was, Cleo McDowell, because like he, in this, he's sort of oddly self-serving, but a nice guy in the end. Which is kind of his complete opposite to his major heel turn he does in Die Hard 2. Where it's like, oh shit, you just killed that guy.
So, he's not a real general.
Yeah, wait a minute. he's teaming up with Death, so, you know. Good old William Sadler, who's in everything.
I didn't realize it, but he actually played the older Kunta Kinte in Roots.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So a weird connection to that kind of throwaway joke.
Yeah, like, especially where they call Akeem that, the barbershop guys. Yeah. But I mean, in general, I think this movie is it still holds up. Like I said, it nearly made my 40 for 40. If I had to completely scrap it and go again or something, or if I had never done it, it may have still made it. This and Trading Places. And I mean, to me, I like Trading Places a little bit better just because it's a bit more harsh and it's a bit more, I don't know, not like dirty is the wrong word, but just that, you know, it's a nastier, harsher kind of movie as well. Like it's just brutal at times. You're like, oh fuck, you know, but like, it's still really funny. So for me, like Trading Places and then Coming to America are the two sort of standouts for Eddie Murphy for me. And then probably like Beverly Hills Cop. And then you can go into other things like, you know, I guess Shrek and stuff like that. But then how much of them would you say is an Eddie Murphy movie? But yeah. But what about you guys? Where do you sort of put Coming to America in the sort of pantheos of Eddie Murphy career?
I can't really rank it because it's been so, like, I haven't watched really any of the Eddie Murphy movies recently. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, you know, like I said, this is the first time I watched this one in 20 years. So you know, and it's been forever since I watched, you know, Beverly Hills Cop, I probably watched more recently, but that was still probably 7-8 years ago.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I can fairly rank it. And I got to tell you, I can't remember the last time I watched Trading Places. I that was probably in the 90s. So, and I don't remember a ton of it. So I probably need to go back and rewatch that one.
We should do that on here just for the sake of it. I think at some point, just to be like, let's see how it holds up, you know, and what's problematic these days and what isn't. But I mean, another one real quick before I let you, Tim, I have to mention Life as well. I always forget that.
Yes.
Life is probably, like, if I had to say what's the best movie that Eddie Murphy is in, that's kind of an Eddie Murphy movie, I would say Life is the, like, the most well-made, like, the best movie. But as far as, like, out-and-out comedies and sort of my favorites, yeah, it'd be Trading Places, Coming to America. So
Dolomite Is My Name is also a great movie.
Oh, yeah.
That's not an Eddie Murphy movie. Like, he's not trying to, he's trying to do something out. But I really like that one.
Yeah. But where, what about you, Tim? Where do you place Coming to America in your sort of Eddie Murphy fandom?
I'm kind of in the same boat as Jared. I at this point, I think I have to confess that I'm not all the way sure I've seen Trading Places.
Oh, or
certainly like not all of it. I think it's maybe one of those things where I caught bits and pieces of it on TV, but that's a very like chopped up version of it.
And, oh yeah, it's very chopped up.
Yeah. And so so I certainly can't put together, you know, a full ranking. Of course, like I know I saw like the Nutty Professor movies when those came out, and the Shrek movies, you know, all the stuff he's done kind of throughout the 90s and 2000s there. But one thing that was kind of, you know, interesting to me watching this is that the movie doesn't confront, and I'd be interested to see how much Trading Places does this, but doesn't kind of confront that intersection of race and poverty in the same way that like Black Panther does, you know, where T'Challa is extremely confronted, you know, Killmonger, you know, brings this in and throws it in his face, like the fact that, you know, you have all of these resources and yet there's Black people living in extreme poverty all over the world. And
Well, Trading Places is all about that. it's played for laughs, but it is like they're either super rich or dirt poor. It's not like and you do have that whole and just, of course, like they literally trade places, and you know, sort of snobby waspy Dan Aykroyd is kind of becomes like Eddie Murphy, but just him dealing with that, and it's like, holy fuck, like, but it's all played for laughs, you know. So
and it seems like the new movie might tackle some of that, because, you know, just the premise from Wikipedia is that Akeem discovers that he has a son he never knew about in America, a street savvy Queens native. So
wait a minute.
See, who
did he hook up with in Queens?
That's the premise. Well, the issue I had with the movie as well. Yeah. It's like, when does that happen? Yeah.
So I'm just looking at the cast list, and right now, Leslie Jones is the mom. So you can tell me that.
Yeah,
I'm in.
So it's bullshit.
They met at the bar, like off camera, and like.
All right, I think I just figured out how that movie will end. Anyway. Yeah, because in the trailer, it's like, did you ever think that maybe your daughter would want to be the next ruler and this kind of thing? And it's like, yeah, that's cool, but so yeah, I think I think
it might be a tip off there, but I'm excited for the next one.
Yeah, I was super keen. Well, when they first announced it, I was like, no. Same as how they were like, we're going to do a sequel to Twins, and it'll be called Triplets, and it'll be Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito, and Eddie Murphy will be the third. Like, they were actually triplets. They weren't twins. And you're like, okay, that would have been funny like 20 years ago. Yeah. I don't know if I want to see that now, but I mean, if Arnold's in it, I'll watch it. Because
the fact that they got so many people from the original cast back on this, gives me a little hope. I could watch it and very well go,
yeah,
oh, I should have stuck with, don't ever do this. We need to stop doing this and making sequels 20 something years, 20, 30 years later. What are we, 40 years later almost?
35? Oh, geez.
Not 33.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a long time, you know, but, you know,
but Bill and Ted did it. God damn it.
Yeah.
So we can see how it turns out, but you know, Amazon has been doing a crazy blitz on it too. Like we were watching House on Amazon, and like every episode before it aired, the commercial for Coming to America. And it's like, if you go on the Amazon Prime homepage on the Apple page, it's Coming to America.
Also,
and
they did Coming to America with a number two. That's how you do it. That's how you title a sequel. The second twins should be just twins, but it's spelled with a two instead of a T. That's how you do it.
And so it's the same thing. They did it with Borat too. And you know, I thought they pulled off that movie pretty well.
Yeah. So that was, I mean, it could be done. I agree though. They are definitely pushing it hard. Cause I watched The Stand recently, and before every episode of that, that was on Amazon, and it was on Amazon at least. And before that it was like, you got the trailer for Coming to America. And then you watched Randall Flagg do his thing, but yeah, geez, that fucking falls off a cliff. I'll tell you. Apparently I'm like that. Cause I never read the book. I'm like, really? That's the fucking, like, that's how the climax happens, and that's the big how we stop the bad guy moment. I'm like, seriously? Like, oh, that must have changed that. There's no way that happens in the book. Looked it up. Yep. I was like, fuck, man. I would fuck this. Yeah.
This is now also our Stand episode.
Yeah, fuck The Stand, kids. Don't bother. but yeah, I think once they announced the sequel, and like you said, Jared, they said everyone was coming back. I was like, okay, cool. It might be all right. But the last couple of the most recent trailer I've seen, I'm sort of thinking like, maybe, but you know, I hope it's good. We'll give it a chance. So.
Yeah. I'll give it a chance. Cause you know, especially since it's coming on Amazon, it's an Amazon thing. I'm not going to theater now. Because of the membership that Tim and I had before COVID, the way we could do movies, I probably would have gone and seen it anyways. But if it was a decision between, you know, actually having to pay for that ticket for that particular show and waiting for video, that would probably be one where I'd have waited and I would have seen the reaction first. Now with it on Amazon, yeah, we'll probably just plan to watch it, you know, that weekend it comes out and see what we think.
Yeah.
Because at that point, you know, we're getting to the bottom of Netflix and Amazon at this point. But then we're running out of Netflix. Yes.
I can't watch Tiger King again. it should be fun. But I mean, all in all, I think Coming to America, like this original one, it still holds up. It's pretty funny. It's one of the better Eddie Murphy movies. Like, yeah, so definitely still thumbs up. So.
And for that reason alone, like I just kind of I you guys were like, we got to talk about Coming to America, and I was like, specifically, who wants to hear three white guys talk about Coming to America?
Yeah.
And we had problems.
To hear us three white guys talk about anything.
Well, yeah.
Jared's not like a white Jew. He's Eddie Murphy in makeup. It's all right. Oh,
that explains a lot. Yeah.
Now I'm confused.
Yeah.
What exactly does that explain? You know what?
But anyway, after having seen Coming to America, that makes me a little bit excited and I'm going to check out the second one when it drops. Because it does hold up. It was a lot of fun to watch.
And like I said, we'll have to do a Trading Places now as well, I think, just because I'd like to get your reactions to it, having not seen it for ages. And then Tim, if you've never seen it from start to finish, I'd be interesting. So
yeah, I think I've maybe never seen all of Blazing Saddles either.
Oof,
yeah. Oh,
I got homework.
Talk about things that you couldn't make anymore.
Again, another movie again where like a lot of people offended by it have missed the point entirely. But anyway, Daryl's a big fan of that too. He'd be good too. Daryl could explain our Beast from the Middle East friend Daryl. He would explain it much better than I ever could. But yeah. Blazing Saddles still has merit anyway. But until we completely get canceled by everything, that's where we'll leave it for this episode. But please follow us all on Twitter. Our show is at UnfunnyNTangent. I'm at GregT13. Jared is at SuperJuice75. Tim is at Tim Agni and attackofthedad.com. But as always, all roads lead to at The Steel Cage. You can also check out our website at unfunnynerdtangent.com. And don't forget to head over to the steelcageshop.com and buy an amazing Mon Milfma t-shirt. I feel we need like a She's Your Queen to Be Mon Milfma variant or something. She's just hopping on one foot or something like that. But yeah, but yeah, that's it for episode 113 of Unfunny Nerd Tangent. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, kids, wipers. Just let your soul go. Just let it shine through. Just let your soul.
Wait a minute. Man goes into a restaurant. You listening? A man goes into a restaurant. He sits down. He's having a bowl of soup. He says to the waiter, "Waiter, come taste the soup." Waiter says, "Is there something wrong with the soup?" He says, "Taste the soup." He says, "Is there something wrong with the soup? Is the soup too hot?" He says, "Will you taste the soup? It's wrong. Is the soup too cold? Will you just taste the soup?" "All right, I'll taste the soup. Where's the spoon?" "Aha. What do you know from funny, you bastard?"
Unfunny Nerd Tangent.